The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 280 for August 16th, 2010, a Monday. Who would have guessed? Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton here in Durham, New Hampshire. On the other end of the Skype line is...
John F. Ron here in Fairfield, Connecticut. And on the other end of the Skype line...
I know. Pilot Pete here in Durham, New Hampshire. I can't believe it. Finally back with
welcome,
you guys.
Welcome, Pete. Yeah, it's good to have you here.
Good to be back.
Awesome. Anything to report today, John, before we dive right into things here? We do have there is no way we'll get through everything on the agenda today. That we know.
I got a new toy, and actually, it does lead to a Mac question.
We said we were going
to
talk about that at the end.
All right, because there is a Mac question involved in there.
All right.
So I'll talk about the toy at the end, because it may be a valid question. So anyways, we'll do it at the end, because, of course, we want to respond to the listener first and not talk about me.
That's right. All right, so let's go with Wes. And Wes has an interesting question, and one that many of us might see for various different reasons. Wes says... I have determined that I have two iTunes store accounts, one using a local email address and one using my mobile me address. One is being used on my iPad and the other on my Apple TV. Both have significant activity. Do I need to worry about this, and or should I try to combine them somehow? If so, how would I go about doing that? If not, are there hints about how I handle this situation in iTunes on my iMac? Okay. So before I answer the question, I want to create yet another scenario here where this might happen, because Wes's scenario is actually more common than you might think, John. But even more common than that is the household, say, similar to what I have, where we have multiple people in the house, each with their own iTunes store account. And yet we want to share not only music, but applications and all of that stuff. And all of that's allowed under the terms of service. So. I have apps on my iPhone that I've purchased under my account and that Lisa has purchased under hers, and vice versa. So the situation in the end is very similar to what Wes describes, just a different path got us there.
So you're talking multiple users, multiple user. I want to be clear here.
Multiple iTunes store accounts.
Right.
Right.
A single Mac account?
Doesn't matter.
Okay, and right. Also, but, obviously, but, multiple devices.
Yes, but in the end, and it doesn't matter. It could be a single device.
Okay.
And in the end, yes, it is multiple iTunes store accounts on either a device or a Mac. And it could be multiple Macs. It could be multiple devices. It really doesn't matter. Okay, so I did do some research about Wes's question about consolidating them, and most people say it's impossible. There was one forum post that was... sort of non-committal in its answer that said to go to apple.com/support/iTunes and click the email us link in the account and billing section. One person sort of inferred they got their accounts merged that way, but I'm not convinced that it actually worked. I'm not sure how Apple would do this, because the apps are all assigned to a given account. In fact, if you go into iTunes and click on apps under your library and do a get info on any one of your apps that you've downloaded, you'll see that it's assigned to a specific user account, listed by email address. You can certainly try that. But for the sake of this discussion, we're going to assume that it's not going to get you where you want to be. My advice going forward is, if you can consolidate your purchases to one account, it doesn't matter in the end if you have to keep them split, like for example Lisa and I do. It's fine, but if you can consolidate, it will make your life a little bit simpler. You can manage your credit cards, you can manage your purchases, but really where it matters is when it comes to updates for those applications. If you buy an app and you buy version 1.2 and then they update to version 1.3, you have to authenticate to download that update free of charge. And this is where it matters which account was used to create it. Now, on your iDevice, iPhone, iPad, iPod Touch, this is actually a pretty smooth process. It will pop up the little window and it'll say enter your password. Look very carefully at the email address that it's showing you there and type in the password associated with the right one. It will ask you for the right email, for the, you know, for the right email address associated with the app that you're updating. If you're updating multiple apps, it will only do one set at a time, but you simply go back in and say, and it'll, you know, ask you to re-authenticate when you update again, and boom, you're good to go. It'll pull the rest. So on the iDevice, it works pretty well. On the Mac, it gets a little more convoluted. In fact, if you are in this situation, you may have seen where under library apps, you get the little number, it gets a little badge next to it that says, you know, the number of apps that you have to update. But when you go in and tell it to update, let's say it says you have 10. But when you actually go to update, it says, well, there's only 7. The reason is those other 3 are known to need updates, but they're not associated with that same account. So what you do is you update the 7 that are associated with the first account. And then you go into iTunes, you click on the iTunes store, and in the upper right corner, click your account and then choose to log out and then sign back in with the other account. At that point, then go click on apps in your library, click on check for updates, and it'll go get the updates associated with that account. Now, if you have 3 accounts, well, do the same thing and get back around. And then once you're done with those, set yourself back to whatever the main account's going to be. For me, what I do is I just let my iPhone or iPad update the ones associated with the alternate account, i.e. Lisa's. And then when I sync, it slurps those updates in and I don't have to worry about the second step. So a little bit convoluted, but not too bad, and certainly a livable situation if that's the path you have to head down. Does that make sense, John?
Yes.
Good.
I think. Well, okay. I'm a single account, single machine, single device type of guy. So.
Your needs are simple, and that's a beautiful thing.
Yes.
All right. So should we go to, is it time to talk about Brent?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. So Brent writes, I have an early 2007 MacBook Pro and I'm on my second battery already. I almost always use this machine when plugged in to the power. So my cycle count is pretty low. However, I was surprised that OS X indicated that my battery needs servicing. Is this normal with a battery with under 100 cycles on it? I guess I'm concerned and wanted to make sure that it's just the battery. Okay. Yes, it is normal. In fact, we've done quite a bit of, we've discussed this on the show, so we're not going to go too deep here, but it's worth revisiting this every 6 months or so because it is the way it is with Apple batteries and probably just about any laptop battery. What we've found is on a machine that you've kept plugged in and don't wind up using the battery much and don't wind up cycling, the battery capacity, that is the amount of charge it takes up until the point it says, no, I'm full, will diminish much faster than it will on a battery that you completely abuse and, you know, either constantly bring it all the way down to zero or back up, or even better, if you bring it down to, say, 50%, charge it up to 80, let it go back down to 30, charge it up to 100%, let it go back down to 60. The more erratic and abusive you can be in terms of how you charge your battery, the longer that battery will last in general. Obviously, we can all go out and find a specific case where, you know, the opposite's true. But we had several hundred, probably over 1,000 people respond to a survey on TMO that kind of confirmed what we had seen in limited test cases here. And that is that, you know, the best thing to do is abuse your battery. If you're and it started with me because I'm exactly like Brent. I leave my computer plugged in all the time. Mm-hmm. And since we figured this out, I've actually scheduled it in my calendar to do a full cycle on my battery every 2 weeks. Now, I know that's not the best thing. The best thing would be to constantly abuse it, but the reality is I'm not going to remember to do that. So at least every 2 weeks, Apple says every month. I didn't find that to be enough. After a month after a year, I had about 30 cycle counts and I was down to about 60% of my battery's capacity, which is, you know, no good. Thankfully, Apple Care will replace the battery for you. If it's less than 80% of its original capacity and with a removable battery less than 300 cycle counts, or with a built-in battery less than 1,000 cycle counts. So that's the way it works. Brent, I know you probably out of warranty, but you might not be. If you are, even if you are out of full AppleCare, call them up. You never know. Mm. They might come around for you. So, John, you were the one that convinced me. It was like you and actually Stephen Swift were the ones that whose usage convinced me that this was something warranting further explanation.
Yeah. And you convinced me. And actually, so Brent, he actually did send us a screenshot.
Right.
I think he used coconut battery. I use battery health monitor.
Okay.
And now, as soon as I saw his numbers, so the numbers that he showed us, his battery's original capacity was 5,600 milliamp hours.
Right.
He was down to a maximum of 4,200 and he only had 80 cycles.
Right.
Now, to give you the metrics for my battery. So basically what I do, Dave, is I will be constantly, as you suggested, I abuse my battery horribly. I'm constantly charging and discharging it, pretty much discharging it. So it gets to the point where you get two messages. You'll get one message where it thinks there's about 10 minutes left.
Right.
And then you get another message where there's about 5 minutes left. And as soon as I get the 5 minute left, then I'll plug it in and I'll ramp it up again. But in my case, so my battery, the maximum was 5,500.
Yep.
Right now, its current maximum capacity is 5,000 after 137 charge cycles.
Yeah, see, that's good.
So basically, by whooping on it, 5,000 to me is very good after that number of charge cycles.
Yeah,
I am convinced this is the right way to do it, and it's probably going to be the last. Well, it's absolutely going to be the last MacBook Pro I'm going to have with this type of battery, and I'll switch between two of them. So I have two batteries, and about every month, I'll go to the other one.
When does the load cycle take over? Because I know it doesn't take you to go all the way down to zero or even 20%, or, you know, it seems to be a fairly high number, like probably 70 or 80%.
No, the way it works is you get the load cycle counter. And for the benefit of our listeners, load cycle, it describes the number of full charges that the battery has had.
Okay.
But it is a cumulative number. So the battery knows, okay, well, I went down to 50% and was charged up to 100. And then I went down to 30% and was charged to 100. And then I went down, you know, and at that point, well, now we've done 50 plus 70. So that's a load cycle plus 20.
Okay.
Okay. And so, yes, even if you have it plugged in all the time and never let it drop down to zero, you will, over time, see the load cycle counter tick over. And the reason is that even when it's on charge, it is draining and charging the battery at different times. In fact, you cannot run, or you should not run, a Mac laptop without a battery in it, because the power connector from the wall does not provide enough power to fully power the CPUs when they're at any significant load.
Right.
And that forces the battery to kind of trickle down and trickle back up and trickle down and trickle up. But it's a very slow process, and as we've said here, not enough to keep the battery alive over a period of time.
Now, I use coconut battery, which is a little free utility to count those load cycles and that sort of thing. It isn't too complex or in-depth, but do you guys use something else?
Well, John said he uses battery health monitor.
Oh, okay.
Brent used coconut battery. I used to use coconut battery. Now, I just use iStat menus.
It's right there.
It's right there. Yeah,
right in front of me.
Yep.
Sure enough.
Yep. Yeah. Now, something else I want to bring up. So I believe that charge cycle is relative to the maximum, to the current maximum capacity of the battery.
At any given time. That's correct.
Not the maximum. But for example, in my case, so my maximum when I got the battery was 5,500. Now it's 5,000. So I think it's relative. So every time I cycle through 5,000 milliamp hours worth of charge, then it's going to click that counter.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay.
That's a great way of putting it.
That's what I thought.
Yep. Yep.
Now, also, someone actually emailed us. Did I? No, I responded to the group. And it's worth mentioning because it was that article, Dave, and someone actually asked us about this issue with if you're not running with the battery about the power, because I do believe the newer power adapters do provide maximum power. And I did find the Knowledge Base article, and it has not been updated. So I believe that statement continues to be true. And I think what effectively happens is the Mac will knock down the processor speed, which in effect draws less power. So that's the big reason you don't want to run without the battery, is your computer is not going to be running at its the processor will not run at its maximum speed.
Yeah, and I had heard some things about you may actually damage something. I don't know, that may have been speculation on the part of the tech that shared that with me, but we'll see. We'll see.
Kind of lame if you damaged it. I mean, that's
it's pretty clear that you're not supposed to run the thing without a battery. Of course, if it really is going to damage it, the OS should just tell you, no, shut down.
Yeah, well, I guess they pretty much enforce it with the latest Macs. Since it's impossible to run it without the battery.
No, not impossible. But
it's very difficult.
Just void your warranty.
Yeah, right, void your warranty on the way. That's right. It doesn't matter at that point. You voided your warranty. Cool. Our first sponsor for this show is Circus Ponies at circusponies.com with Notebook. Notebook is their flagship product, and what it does is it's built for you to consolidate all the information on any given topic or subject, really anything you want. A little bit daunting when you launch it because all you see, well, you see something very familiar. It's just a notebook, white lined, ready for you to do whatever you like. Now, we all know what to do with a notebook. We write in it. So with a computer, we type in it. However, you can do a whole lot more than that. As you're typing, of course, you can use an outline form. And of course, the text is all saved. But what's really cool is when you start pulling in other pieces of collateral, images, faxes, PDFs. You can even bring in, we had one listener who was pulling in the audio file, the MP3 from a Mac Geek Gab episode. And then was as he listened, he was going through and putting in little notes about what we said, links, and building essentially one notebook for each Mac Geek Gab. And that way, if he thought back and said, oh, hey, you know, I know that John and Dave talked about batteries, but when was that? And so he can go through and search and find, here's what they talked about. Here's the notes I took. Here's the time at which it happened. Scroll forward in the episode and listen away. You can do this. You don't have to do it with our show. You can do it with classes that you're taking. You can do it with, say, you're planning an event at home and, you know, you want to pull things in. It might be a Labor Day party. It might be a back to school event where you're just pulling all this stuff together and you want to have all the data in one place. PDFs, images, all inside Notebook. Pete's raising his hand.
Yeah. I actually, it's got a pretty good little to-do thing in there, too. You can set up a nice to-do list. Yeah. And as you check them off, it moves it from the incomplete to the completed. So you can run that in there, too. It's a perfect organizer.
Wow. Very cool. Okay. And this is Circus Ponies Notebook. It's available at circusponies.com. It is $49.95 US, but of course they offer a 30-day free trial. So go ahead, download it, check it out. In fact, you could even plan your entire Labor Day party with it. You've got plenty of time because within 30 days, Labor Day is going to be long gone and you either had a successful event or, well, let's just hope you had a successful event. Try it out. Once you're convinced, back to circusponies.com, $49.95. Let them know where you heard it. They always appreciate that. And if you have your story with Circus Ponies Notebook, go ahead and send it in because we always like to share real world cases here on the show. All right. We talked in the last show, the last non-premium show, about Powerline, John. I mentioned it at the very end, and we got a lot of comments about it. The first thing I want to say, and I mentioned this in the premium show we did, number 279, I mentioned Powerline AV500 in the show. That's not out yet, and I don't have it. What I'm using is Powerline AV200, which is the 200 megabit, the current fastest version that you can get, although 500, they say, is coming some point in, at least from Netgear, which is the vendor I was using, some point, maybe September, we should see the 500 megabit version. But I'm using the 200, so I just wanted to get that out there. Anything to comment on there, John, before we go to Connor's question about Powerline?
The only tip, I suspect that something was up too, because, you know, you gave me a link to the product. And then, I think someone either tweeted me saying I can't find it or he tweeted us. And so the way I kind of concluded that it wasn't available, Dave, I particularly like this site, is frugal.com. It's from those Google guys. And
yep.
If something exists and you put in even a model number, it'll show you lots of places that you can get the product. And I put in that model number and it came up with nothing. And in my experience, if Frugal comes up with nothing, you either typed it in wrong or It's not yet available. Right. And in this case, that I think it's coming out in the fall, you said? Or
yeah, that's what they say. But for now, and perhaps going forward, the AV200 is certainly fast enough for what I'm doing here and has been extremely reliable. But we're gonna answer some questions. Both Connor and Wesson had some specific questions about power lines, so we'll take those in turn.
Mm-hmm. Hey, guys. Connor P. again. Apologies for my extreme verbosity recently, but you guys just have such an interesting show. I can't help myself. My question this time is regarding that power line networking you were talking about. Dave, if you don't mind me asking, how is the wiring in your house? Because I live in about a 100-year-old house with some pretty gnarly electrical wiring. Some of it's been replaced, some of it's still very old. And that kind of thing would make me worry about how well that the power line networking would work. If it would work, I'd be really interested in trying it. And also, do you know if any of these, like specifically the brand that you tried, the Belkin, no, the Netgear one, do they have like a 30-day money-back thing? Because if it doesn't work in my house, I don't want to try it if there's any risk. But if it might work, I'd be interested in trying. Thanks, guys.
Okay, so in general, the wiring in my house is about 40 years old. I don't think the wiring has been replaced in any significant capacity since the house was built. So, I think we've got, it's not 100-year-old wiring, but I think it's fine. So, Pete, John, anybody? Well, I know you guys both have comments. So,
well, I want to chime John's in here. So I do have a house that's about 100 years old, but it has been redone,
right?
Because before I purchased it, it had to be brought up to code, and part of that involved replacing the electrical wiring. So what I did is I went to one of my walls, ripped it apart, and no, I didn't. I went in the basement.
That's the place to look.
Don't rip your and don't play with the sockets to find out the wiring. So basically, I went downstairs, I went to the fuse box, and I checked what was coming out of it. And I have 100-amp service, which is probably pretty reasonable for a small single-family house.
That's pretty weak, actually.
That's low, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, everything works.
All right, well, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, I've never blown a fuse by having too many things on one circuit, including ACs and all this. Everything's spread around, but the main breaker does say 100 on it.
Okay.
So anyways, but I checked the wiring, the main electrical wiring, and here's what it says on it. And I would say that if you have this wiring, you're probably in good shape. It says on it, Romex 14/2. What does the 14 and the 2 mean, Dave?
Do you want me to ask? John, what does the 14 and the 2 mean?
Well, I found out I did, of course, Google is tells you everything. The 14 is the gauge of wiring, and the 2 is the number of wires going through that. And basically, when I looked online, that's a pretty common grade of wire for residential, regular duty house wiring. And everything that I had was this grade of wire. There are some others that I think you guys mentioned, but this seems to be something that's pretty common. And 14 is the gauge, which is the thickness of the wire. And I think Pete has a little of it, because I saw another grade of wire. It was 12/3 that's sometimes also used. So that's 12 gauge wire and I guess 3 conductor for what, 3 phase, I guess,
right,
dryers, yeah. And other things. So, yeah, so I think I may have one run out of that.
It's going to be a slightly thicker wire.
It's a smaller number, but it's thicker.
That's right.
Pete, how could that, no sense.
It's inside out. It's upside down. It goes back I forget what I just read, like the Birmingham gauge system or something like that, but it's all standardized now. And it's the number of times you can pull a given thickness of wire through a draw plate. That's how they that's how they initially did it. So the smaller the number, the fewer number of wires you could get through that hole in the draw plate, and therefore the larger the number.
Ah, that's interesting. And you said
the smaller the number.
The smaller the number, the larger the wire. Right. Right. Interesting.
So that's why it's backwards. And it's the same thing with weapons, too. The 12 gauge shotgun is bigger than the 14 gauge, which is bigger than the 20 gauge, because it was the number of balls of shot that you could get in a given volume for that given shot. So it's the same type of system, which goes back to
somewhere.
Yeah. Ancient.
It's ancient. It's old enough that it ain't going to change.
Exactly. And while it seems backwards, that's the method by which they initially gauge these out.
So, yeah, my guess is, I mean, any rewiring that I've done in my house, I've also done with 14.2. And my guess is the rest of the house is 14.2. From what I've seen, it all looks to be. I do happen to have two different circuit breakers in my house that are linked together. When I talked to the people at Netgear about this, they said, really, how do they phrase it? As long as they're close enough together in the circuit breaker panel, the signal is going to jump from one wire to the other. And obviously that happens because I've got things on multiple circuits. Yeah. It's like, I don't know how close to the circuit panel I want to be.
How do it know?
That's right.
Well,
yeah.
Well, I would assume this for most residences is that you have a single wire from the pole to the house and then it splits from there.
That is correct. Yeah. Well, yes, I have a single wire from the pole to the house and then I have another wire to the office. So my guess is that I could not do power line between the office and the house because they're two separate buildings. Now, it could reach back out to the street. In fact, that would be an interesting experiment that I'm definitely going to have to try now that we're talking about it.
I'll bet a steak dinner that won't happen.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm buying Pete a steak now.
Dave may be the steak dinner if he experiments with
plug
that.
Plug that in there.
Yeah, but why wouldn't it, right? I mean, the pole, and that presents a security concern with these, right? And I was talking to somebody about this at the Princeton Mac user group meeting. They were asking, well, can my neighbor bridge in if he's on the same pole as me? And I thought, well, that's an interesting question. And so I could test it here. I didn't even think about it at the time that I actually have the capacity.
You'd have to be on the same brand and model number.
Well, bridge. The power line is power line.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Even if I had, let's say I had three different, three of the same one from Netgear, I can set them up in a security mode where they will not talk to anyone that I have not authorized. There's a way you can do it with hardware just by pressing buttons on them and it automatically kind of syncs up. Or you can go in with the software and program your own passwords in that they have to use to talk to each other and encrypt their data. So,
oh, that's smart.
Which is smart.
Yeah.
So I do have them secure because it's just as easy to set them up secure as not. So in theory, if my neighbor could do it, he couldn't. But yeah, I got to test this out. I got to get one and put it in here at the office and see if it bridges the great divide there, because that'd be pretty darn cool.
You know, that does bring up an interesting question, because our power company now allows you a very basic way to query your meter, and that but they only let me do it four times a month. But I can, so. You know, if I'm in couch potato mode and I don't want to walk outside and actually look at the reading, yeah, I can actually go on the web. Yeah. So I can actually, but it does offer some more data. So our company, and I'm hearing more and more do this, I can actually click on a button and it will somehow get to my electric meter. It will not only show me the current reading, which of course I could just look at it, but it shows me the consumption history for the last couple of hours in like 12-minute increments, which is really cool.
That's cool.
Because then you can tell, like I tried this one time. I'm like, well, gee, you know, I wonder if I have both air conditioners on.
Right.
How many kilowatt hours am I drawing? Well, this will show you.
Cool.
But I'm also thinking,
is if it would do it with SNMP and then you could like graph it with something and build this real time graph, because that would be cool.
I saw a product at one of these Echo Focus shows that actually you would jack into your fuse box and it would on a circuit by circuit basis. Let you look at the consumption, that though it wasn't cheap.
I can't imagine it would be.
but you know, for a big place where, sure, you know, you want to focus in on anything, but they had a thing where it would, you know, tell you if a certain appliance was on the blink, you know, based on the power consumption profile, if it was starting to break down or something like that. It was neat. But the other thing I want to bring up, Dave, is that I do believe that, you know, the similar thing may apply if you're with a cable modem or other network device. I haven't checked this lately, but I'm going to assume that if I plug into my cable modem and do not put a firewall between me and the big wide world, is I'm going to be seeing a lot of stuff out there, or maybe they're smart enough to help firewall. I don't think they are.
It depends. I mean, there's some ARP packets that, and I haven't tried it in a long time. I haven't looked, but there's some ARP packets that would make it through. Tons and tons of ARP packets actually would make it through.
Yeah. Yeah. They're doing address resolution.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, could be.
But I'm not even going to try it because my assumption is, yeah, plugging directly into any sort of, you know, distributed shared network will subject you to all sorts of shenanigans.
All right, I'm gonna pull on the reins a little bit here and answer Wesson's Powerline question and get us back on track. Wesson says, I used the Netgear Powerline devices for several years until I hardwired the house with Cat 6 last year. The ones I used worked, but would get very hot and then crap out until I unplugged them and let them cool off. Do you have similar problems with the new models? The answer is very simple. No. In fact, this was one of the things that that they worked very hard to fix. Pete, in fact, you had some of the old ones, and that's exactly what happened to them, and they overheated and never turned back on again.
Yeah, they bricked, and they're nice paperweights, I guess, if you want to use them for that.
But. That's right. That's right. We threw them away. But yeah, this was a problem with these, and was frankly a very common problem, not just with Netgear, but I think with all the brands. But now the new, and that's why I say get the new Powerline AV200 or better. But the Powerline AV stuff is definitely much better about this. I have not had a problem. July got pretty hot here, and it hasn't been an issue. In fact, I checked them the other day just to see after I got Wesson's question, and they were, you know, cool to the touch. So no problem whatsoever.
And I'm not sure if those early ones, I know I had the problem. I tried to put two different ones in my house and I was getting some collisions of some data or something and it didn't work. Then those bricked. I've got a new one now that allows me to do up to three devices, but I think you're reporting using more than one as well. And then there's no data problem. So they figured out whatever data collision problem there might have been in the early days too. So
it's
pretty cool to be able to unlimit that. I mean, it's, no more pulling wires through walls and ceilings and floors. And
right. Nice. And, you know, they do have very small, and I don't know the brands off the top of my head, Netgear may, but they do have very small versions of these Powerline adapters. So you could put one in your laptop bag. In fact, I talked to a guy from Atheros when I was out at CES, and that's the company that creates the Powerline technology that's sort of baked into all of these things. And what he does is in his laptop bag, he keeps one of these Powerline deals. And as he goes around the house, he just jacks in, and every wall outlet is an Ethernet outlet for him. And he just jacks right into it and he's good to go. He says it's better than trying to deal with wireless. Now, of course, you know, he's well steeped in the Powerline Kool-Aid because it's what he does. But it was pretty cool to hear about that use case that he just, you know, bounces around when he needs a network jack. He just plugs into the wall. He's good to go.
Now, the other question I don't know if you can answer or not. They say you're not supposed to use like the monster strip the power strip, the filters and all that. Are you using any of those or are you right into the wall?
I'm plugging right into the wall. The ones that they sent me are actually the Powerline AV Plus. And what those have is they've got a pass through connector on them. So you plug it into the wall and then it's got an Ethernet jack on one side of it and another power jack on it. So I can plug my power strip into that and feed off, but the Ethernet is left to its own device. Yeah, I have not tried it off of a power strip, but I can imagine that would filter it either completely or significantly. Yeah. Anything else on this one, John, before we move on to the option key?
Move on.
Okay. Connor and Kelly, actually. Kelly tweeted us. Connor wrote us. And there were actually and far more than those two. Connor wrote, Dennis in show 278 said you had to hold down the option key to reopen a hidden window in the application switcher, but you realized that you did not have to. The situation in which you use that option key is when you want to switch to an app that doesn't currently have an open window, but you want to open a new window. If I close the mail app window with Command W, switch away from it, then if I Command Tab to it normally, mail activates because you see mail's menu bar. But if you want to reopen the mail window, you need to follow the option key instructions provided by Dennis. Also, if you want to make it easier to see which apps are hidden, you can run a terminal command, which makes hidden apps dock icons translucent. And there is a command, it's defaults, write com.apple.dock show hidden dash bool space yes, and we'll link to a site that shows you that command so you don't have to write it down. But that's actually very cool. Kelly points out something a little bit different. And she said the option key also works for bringing up minimized windows rather than hidden. If you move to an app that has minimized windows without holding down the option key, they will not maximize. So you have to hold down the option key to do that. So thank you, Dennis, for bringing this topic up. And thank you, Connor and Kelly and everyone else for writing in and setting the record straight. Anything on that, John? Have you done any testing there?
No.
You're right.
I'm a simple guy. Yeah, I don't do any of these fancy acrobatics with all these windows and keys and stuff.
But it's our job to do the fancy acrobatics.
No, sometimes I do.
All right. I guess I will read Will's comment and then we'll do our second sponsor because Will kind of leads right into it. But Will wrote in about our second sponsor, which is Gazelle.com. And his quick note was a quick note of thanks for turning a bunch of my techno junk into cash. Not only do I have a few extra bucks in my pocket, the wife is thrilled that I've purged some of the cash of crap. I guess we might as well talk about Gazelle here to keep this straightforward. But and then we'll go on to the rest of Will's comment, which is unrelated. But what Gazelle is our second sponsor for this show. And what Gazelle does is it allows you to turn your gadgets into cash and you go. It's cool. What I recommend you do is you go to their site and you click on and you go to gazelle.com and you click on the actually you just type in what you have. Could be an iPhone, could be a MacBook, could be an old cell phone, could be really anything. And once you kind of drill down, you might type iPhone and then they'll ask, okay, well, is it an original? Is it a, 3G, 3GS, iPhone 4? And how big is it? You drill down, you find out what it is. And then they'll ask you some questions. Is it in good shape? Does it have water damage? Does it work? Does it have the box? Does it have the accessories, et cetera, et cetera? And then they'll give you a price. And the cool part is you get to pick at that point. Do you want to send it in or not? And if you do, with most things, they'll actually send you a box and they'll cover the shipping. When they get it, they confirm that it's in the same shape that you described. And assuming that it is, they'll send you a check or a PayPal or really whatever it is you want to do. If it doesn't match, if it's more, they'll tell you, hey, we're going to give you more. Cool. And then they'll send you more. If it's less, they'll tell you that too and give you the option. If you don't want what they say it's worth, they'll send it back to you and it's yours. No loss, no harm, no foul. If you want it, great. They'll take the cash and off they go. I recommend you just go there and check it out because it really gives you an idea of what the old gadgets and as Connor put it, as Will put it, the crap that you have lying around is worth. And it might very well be worth something. And you can bundle a bunch of them together and, boom, maybe you turn it into, something significant. You go out and get yourself a new iPad or something with the winnings from all your gadgets. So it's gazelle.com. Now, here's the cool part. When you do send something in, use the code MACGEEK. That's our code. And what it gets you is 5% more than whatever they quote you for your device. So if they say it's worth $100, well, now it's worth $105 and that's on us. It's on them, but it's through us. And the same goes for whatever. If it's $50, well, okay, now it's an extra $250. If it's, $1,000, well, you just got an extra $50. So gazelle.com for all cash, for all your gadgets, go just play with it. That's all I recommend is just go play with it. And you'll get hooked. You'll wind up sending something in. I did. Everybody does. It's cool. Gazelle.com. Anything on that, John, before we move back to Will here?
I got to send in some of my stuff.
Yeah, it's cool. It's fun. Just go, actually, go around with it.
Well, actually, yes, Dave, at the end of the show, I may talk about an item that I will need to.
That's right.
At the end of the show.
That's right. Okay. So Will says, also a big thanks for the advice on my Mac Pro. This is a good little story. With the seemingly fried motherboard. Well, it turns out it was the motherboard. And of course, I was 1 month out of my AppleCare warranty. However, I hauled the 60-pound monster to my local Apple store here in Cincinnati, and the extremely helpful geniuses confirmed the worst. Though, because the machine was completely clean and I clearly knew what I was talking about, thanks to your advice, the kind folks offered to replace the board at no cost and replaced my video card just because it sounded like the fan might be a little loose if you tilted the machine slightly. So not only did they save me $1,000, they took precautions for other possible future out of warranty issues. So two lessons. AppleCare, as you say, a must, even on desktops, and go in knowledgeable, well-maintained hardware. That equation seems to have worked out brilliantly in this case. And it is true. Apple, the AppleCare warranty ends, but I think it's, and I don't know this for sure, but my guess is that your AppleCare warranty actually runs a month longer than it states. I have to think that based on all the feedback that we've gotten. I can't guarantee it. Of course, Apple will never guarantee it. But
certainly their corporate culture is,
yes,
we want you to have a good experience.
That's right.
I had an issue once with my sons in a repair shop, and Apple stepped in and said, well, we're going to cover that for you anyway.
Right. Right.
Incredible.
Yeah. Well, they also know how many Macs you've bought.
Exactly. Right? And they know I'm going to buy another one, yes, particularly if they keep me happy.
Right. So. And probably even if they don't.
Right.
But, well, you know, that's right.
Don't mess.
All right. What are we moving on to here, John? Saved searches?
Kevin?
Kevin, yeah?
All right. Yeah, that's a good tidbit, I think.
Okay, all right. Well, then we'll share this tip from Kevin.
Hi, John and Dave and Pilot Pete. This is Kevin here in the UK. Just been listening to Mac Geek Gab 277, and specifically your tip on trying to search your Mac for various things, but primarily how to search the library, which doesn't normally come up in a find. What I've done is actually saved a search criteria, which obviously you can do now under Snow Leopard. I've included that on with my email, so you can perhaps make that available through the webpage. But yes, you just set up your search criteria as normal, and then in the top left there, you'll see a little option to save that, and it'll add it to the sidebar. Hope this helps. Keep up the great work. Cheers.
Well, thanks, Kevin. That's pretty good. And how did he know you'd be here today?
I don't know.
I know.
How do you do that?
We do have do you have a comment on this, or I'm going to play the other one from our friend in France here about the save searches right in a row to keep some consistency going, John, but do you have anything to add about Kevin's before we move on?
I think I'll add it afterwards.
Okay. All right. Let's cue this one up.
Hi guys. This is Bukaru from Montreal, Quebec.
Oh, sorry.
Regarding show 2.
My apologies. I made the assumption based on your name that you were from France, but of course you're Canadian. You're our neighbor to the north here. So I'll start that again, and I'll introduce you as our friend from Canada.
Hi, guys. This is Bukaru from Montreal, Quebec. Regarding show 277, you said that you weren't able to search system file in the library directory or the preference directory if you're not searching inside that directory. This is true, but you can remedy to that if you search for something, as you said, and then you add criteria with the plus sign at the end of the title bar that says search this Mac, and then you choose the on the second line, you choose the pull-down menu, which says kind. You go to other, and then you search for system. And you should find system files with a description saying include system files such as preference and plugins. And you have a checkbox at the end, end menu, and you check that. You push OK, and then you can, on the same pull-down menu that says kind, you can choose, now you can choose system files. It should appear on that menu. And then you select are included. And then you can, from now, you can search system files like preference and library. So this is my trick of the week. Thank you. This is where you cut me off.
All right. Thank you very much. That's a great, great tip, too. So go ahead, John.
Yeah, there's a huge list of things when you type into that other. I'm amazed at the number of things there. The only thing I want to mention, the mechanics of this. So I think it's actually a smart folder when you save this. And what it does for you, which I thought was kind of neat. So it'll save it in your user directory /library/. Well, you don't have to do the slash. Saved searches. Then, yes, as the first tip said, there's a little checkbox saying add to sidebar. I wonder why you wouldn't want to add it to the sidebar unless you don't want it, you know, really crowded.
Right.
But I just want to offer that. So in case you don't save it into the sidebar and you do want to find it again, that is where it places those for you.
Cool.
No, nice feature. I almost always learn something in every show.
You know, amazing. I'm going to throw something in off the wall here. You can add even more to that list by installing Spotlight plugins. And Apple's got a bunch of them on their site, but I think you can get them elsewhere. If you go to apple.com/download/macOS/Spotlight, you'll see Spotlight plugins that add even more functionality to Spotlight there. Spotlight's pretty cool. I know we sort of moan about it sometimes because it winds up chewing on the processor and the disk and taking up a bunch of resources when it's indexing itself. But the reality is it can be pretty cool. You've just got to tweak it and make it work to be your friend. So,
yeah, the only complaint I have is sometimes it'll get a little aggressive about what it thinks it should be indexing, especially sometimes I've seen this and I'm not quite sure why it happens, but it'll try to index a drive where I said, no. And you know, even if you explicitly put it in the Spotlight place saying, please don't do this, which is actually, yeah. So system preferences, Spotlight privacy, and then there'll be a little window that says prevent Spotlight from searching here. And you just put in the drives
or the folders.
Or the folders, yeah. You can put anything in there, and those will not show up. Though I think we discussed it before, Dave. It actually does index everything.
No.
This just no?
No. So there's two things in the Spotlight preferences. One is you can check the items that you want to appear in the results list.
Right.
And that, everything is indexed whether or not it's checked there. You just are choosing what results you want. But
right.
On the other side, when you go to the privacy tab, if something is there and it's working properly, and you're right, sometimes it doesn't work properly. But if it's listed there and everything's working properly, it won't even index. So the privacy tab is different from the appearance or whatever the first tab is. I don't have it in front of me.
Oh, search results.
Search results. Right. Right.
Got it. Okay, good. Yep. Wanted to clarify that.
Yeah.
I know there was a little subtlety in what both of those do.
That's right. Yeah. So if you go in there and you uncheck, say, applications, it still will index your applications. It just won't show them to you in your search results. So if you turn it back on, those results will be there immediately. Unless, of course, you filtered the location for those results in the privacy tab, and then it won't index them at all. So.
Right.
Cool. Let's answer Vito's question, John. Does that sound good? I like this question.
Oh, I like that one. Yeah,
okay.
Well, that's because I think I got it. But
all right.
Well, we'll discuss.
That's right. There's a long email trail here. I think I'm going to try my best to explain it. Vito writes, I just bought a 2 terabyte USB eSATA Phantom drive for Mac Mall for backing up, Time Machine, etc. In rough tests, it's about 5 times as slow as my internal drives in copying. That doesn't sound right. You want to take it from here, John, or do you want me to keep reading this email trail between us and Vito?
Well, I think I can describe what he was viewing here by going into a calculation here.
Okay.
So anyways, I'm looking at part of my response then, but basically he gave us an amount of data and an amount of time.
Yep.
Where it took to do things. So the way that I quickly tried to boil this down into an effective, now the rate that you want to get in this case to determine what the heck's going on, in my opinion, is megabytes per second.
Right.
Now, that's not always stated clearly. And sometimes, for example, so here he was, of course, talking gigabytes per hour. Okay.
Okay.
Well, going from hours to minutes, that's pretty easy, right?
60.
Right. And going from gigabytes to megabytes is, you know, pretty straightforward. The tool that I like to use, Dave, and Google, you know, Google is just so smart sometimes. So Google has a little feature where either in Google itself or I even think the Google bar in Safari, if you type in a number and a unit, it could be a single unit or it could be a something per something. And then you do an equals and then a question mark. And then what you want it converted to, it will tell you.
That's right.
Isn't that spiffy?
Right.
So basically what I came up with were some very rough rates here. Or you could, you know, divide by 10. It's not exactly right, but it'll get you in the ballpark. So basically using his internal drive, he was getting a rate of about 106 megabytes per second.
That's crazy.
Well, no, that's good. That's a good rate.
There's no way he was getting 106 megabytes a second.
Internally?
Right? There's no. What kind of drive is that?
Well, I'm going to tell you, Dave.
Okay.
Gee, maybe there's another benchmark I could use, Dave. And I'm going to give you another benchmark, Dave.
Okay.
The mechanical drive that I just bought for my computer.
Yeah.
Check this out.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the eSATA interface, now he probably has a SATA for an internal drive. I'm going to assume that it's on a SATA interface, probably SATA 2.
Correct.
That's 3 megabits per second. Of course, you're never going to reach that.
Gigabits.
Yes, that's what I said.
No, you said mega.
No, I said giga. Well, you may have heard it. Anyways.
Recording.
All right, hold on. Let's go back. Anyways, no, you're correct. So eSATA is either 1.5, 3, or 6 gigabits per second, depending on whether it's 1, 2, 3. So, for example, the drive that I just got, Dave, when I decided to get a mechanical drive, and here was the important figure, and I was trying to get this from Vito, and I couldn't get the exact model of drive because you really need the spec sheet for the exact model of drive. My drive has a platter to interface speed of 1,245 megabits per second.
Okay.
What does that come out to in megabytes per second, you ask? And I'll tell you, 155.
Okay. Have you tested it at that? Because that's really fast for a mechanical drive.
Yes, it is. When I got this drive, Dave, I did my homework. This is one of the fastest drives. And the thing is, this is really the figure that you want to look at when you're getting any sort of drive. You don't care about the interface because you're probably, unless you have an SSD, you're probably never going to reach that. And obviously, as we've discussed in the past, SSDs are faster. But anyways, so what I'm trying to say is that 106 megabyte per second figure he was getting, to me, sounded reasonable for an internal drive on a SATA interface, okay?
It seems really fast, right? Because SSDs aren't clocking it. I mean, most SSDs...
Well, there may be some inaccuracy because he was giving me figures in big lumps, okay?
Right.
He was saying gigabytes and hours.
I'm gonna derail our conversation, though, here, because this is... it's fine, you know. Have you... your drive, that you say clocks in at, what 155... Right?
Megabytes.
Right.
That's correct.
Have you tested that with a drive benchmark utility like Drive Genius?
I can bring them up, but I was reaching over 100 at times. I can get the exact benchmarks. I don't have them in front of me.
Yeah, because that's really fast. I mean, it is. Yeah, that's smoking for a mechanical
for
drive.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
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 No, I've discussed this in the past. For small block sizes, I would not typically reach that. But once I started getting into large contiguous block sizes, yes, you're never going to reach it. But it's a good figure. And actually, I know I have it on my portable right now, but I don't want to derail the conversation, even though you did your best. No. Now the thing was,
because I on the next show, I would love to talk about that, because that's, like I said, that's really fast for a mechanical drive. For a single mechanical drive to break 100, that's a lot. So
again, I think I can bring them up while you're talking about something else. I'll bring those up because I did the benchmarks because I was expecting you and I to have a knockdown drag out SSD versus mechanical drive and why what I did was not totally lame. Right. So the thing is, when I did the calculation for his USB drive with the numbers that he gave me, I came up with a throughput of about 21 megabytes per second.
Okay.
Now, since he was connecting it with USB 2, and so I poked around a little bit online, and I think effectively, USB 2, you'll be lucky to get 30 megabytes per second.
Right. That's right.
Even though in theory it may be maximum, there's overhead, and USB is, you know, driven by the host and all that stuff there. So to answer his question, in my opinion... USB in this case is the bottleneck.
Sounds like it. Yeah, if his drive can go faster than the 35, let's say, that he might get out of USB 2 or FireWire 400, then it sounds like that's the bottleneck.
Right. So if I had the exact model, so I think he did say he had a WD7200 RPM drive, which doesn't tell me enough to determine what the maximum speed is. But he did say it's an eSATA drive, and, and this is where I actually learned a little something, or I got additional information. We had, I'm going to say hi to our friend Duffy, because actually we helped him solve this problem at one point. He has a Mac Pro, and he has external eSATA drives.
Right.
And he was having some weird behavior, and it was funny because I was looking at his description of the problem, and all of a sudden I looked at the particular eSATA interface he bought, and I'm like, by the way, Duffy, did you plug or unplug this drive while the computer was on? And his answer was yes. And I'm like, well, your particular eSATA interface says that's a bad thing to do, equivalent to doing that to the drives inside of your computer.
Right.
When I wrote back to Vito, I said, well, my conclusion is that eSATA will certainly, if there's any sort of bottleneck, would certainly be a faster option.
Sure.
And then, but then I got some feedback from a few folks online, including you, Dave, I think, saying eSATA may be hot swappable.
Depends on the interface.
But I do not think it's guaranteed. Like with USB and FireWire, it's guaranteed to be hot swappable in that you could still screw things up, but at least they're advertised where you can do it while the computer's on. You may have to eject, but other than that, they're all advertised to be able to do that.
The bus will re-enumerate when you add or remove a device and recognize it. Now, if you pull a device out mid-copy or even without properly ejecting it from the Mac, you may damage your data. But the computer's going to know, that device went away and that's cool, or it came back and that's cool too. With some eSATA, that's fine, and with others, as you found with Duffy's machine, the bus just isn't, only does its enumeration once and that's its startup, so it just really can't deal with it leaving because it doesn't know to kind of re-go and scan that bus. So cool.
Whew.
All right. So I'm curious to hear about your Drive Genius results. That I found Drive Genius to be the best program on the Mac to do drive benchmarks. It's really clear cut. It checks everything out, and I like it. It's excellent.
I'm glad you talked about Drive Genius, Dave, because I just realized that they came out with a new version recently.
Yeah, version 3, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Right. And I'm going to be trying out because I asked our friends there, if I could take a look at the new improved features.
Sure. So. Cool. Yeah. I'd be curious to hear that. All right. So we've got a couple more things to talk about. I'm going to talk about one thing here and then we'll let you and then you'll talk about one thing, too. And then we'll get out of here because we're wrapping up on many of our shows in the past, including at least one Cool Stuff Found show. I and our listeners have mentioned the program Hazel, and it's always been on my list of things to try someday. Well, someday was about a week and a half ago when I'd used it and, I had a license for it. I was ready to go, but I just never really dug in preparing the speech that I gave at Princeton last week, which was all about Cool Stuff Found. I thought Hazel might really be one of these cool things to mention. So I went through and installed it, and now I will never give it up. So this software is really cool. It sits on your Mac, and the idea behind it is that it will allow you to manage a folder and do various different things. I'm sure you could do a lot of this with folder actions. It's sort of like folder actions on steroids. And the thing that they set it up with is your downloads folder, the folder that's constantly having stuff thrown at it. And even their default actions give you an idea of what you can do. Now, when you install Hazel, just to be clear, none of these actions are enabled by default. They're pre-built, but you have to turn them on. So nothing's going to happen without you going in and specifying that this is going to do it. But they've got one thing in there that is built to highlight new items. So it goes through and anything that's been downloaded or added to that folder in the last day, it highlights in red. And then there's another action that says anything that's older than a day, make it not red anymore. So you've got this constantly changing and updating. So if your downloads folder gets full, you can start seeing, what did I just put here? What isn't new? And then you can actually go and say, highlight things that are more than 4 weeks old of a different color. So you can see, this one's getting pretty stale. Maybe I should go and clean that stuff out. It's also got a trash management feature a lot of people coming over from the Windows side are very used to an automatically emptying trash can. This allows you to do that. You can say, look, keep items in the trash for a day, a week, a month, you know, 2 weeks, however long you want to set it to, or you can have it set to be a trash can that, you know, maxes out at, you know, 1 gigabyte. So if your trash gets bigger than 1 gigabyte, just, you know, start deleting the stuff that's older than that. And it'll constantly keep going through this. Very, very cool thing. And then, of course, the last thing that it adds is an app sweeper type deal, where when you take an application and move it to the trash, it will notice and say, hey, that app has a bunch of other files related to it. Do you want me to trash those too? And if you say yes, and it'll even show you what they are, so you can pick and choose and say, well, my preference is no, but the rest of these support files, yes. And off they go. And then if you drag the app back in from the trash, it'll offer to pull all that stuff back, as long as it's still there, of course. But very, very cool stuff. Oh, and one other thing, John, in the downloads folder examples, just to give you an idea what this thing can do, you can have it download, let's say, music, right? If you download music files, you can have it automatically add any music files that it sees in your downloads folder to a playlist in iTunes. So you could create like a Hazel playlist, and then that, or even a downloads playlist, right? And have Hazel shovel any music into your iTunes. So that way you don't have to think, oh, I downloaded that, but, you know, I didn't sync to my iPod because I didn't bring it into iTunes. Dummy me, right? Totally handles it for you. So yeah, very cool stuff. I knew, in fact, I think when we talked about it before, John, I knew it was one of those things that once we started using it, we'd be hooked on it. And that's totally been true for me. So Hazel, there you go. I know it's not a Cool Stuff Found show, but we'd mentioned it in Cool Stuff Found enough, and I'd never actually done anything with it. So I wanted to take a minute and preach its features, because it's pretty darn cool. So
they need to be a new sponsor now.
I know. Well, they probably don't need to be, right? I'm ranting about the stuff anyway, but you're right. All right, John.
So I did bring up one benchmark that I found. So it's not Drive Genius, it's Xbench, but it's a benchmark. And for large block sizes, the drive that I have right now, got figures in, I'm looking at the best ones here,
yeah,
about 86 megabytes per second.
That's pretty darn fast. Wow.
I mean, when we had our spirited discussion about the wisdom of me upgrading from an older 5400 right to a 7200, it wasn't the only parameter that went up. And the thing is, they had a bigger, and it was just faster overall.
Right.
But I would say the throughput doubled. So
that's great.
You know, you're correct in that an SSD will always give you better speeds.
Well, to be fair, the SSD, even when I was running the SSD on a USB 2 interface, so totally maxing out at, you know, 480 megabits per second on the best day, which, you know, translates to, you know, maybe 30. I was getting about 31, 32 megabytes a second when I bench test the SSD on the USB. But it was the latency that made the drive faster. In fact, I noticed almost no difference moving the SSD from USB to eSATA. And can I get more acronyms into the sentence? So go ahead. Sorry.
Well, and then the last thing. Can I talk about my toy now?
Yeah, go.
All right. So here we go. So basically, I got a new toy here. So I noticed something over the weekend. So I like Redbox, and I think you've used them too. But they're, you know, basically $1 a night rentals. And so the other... And you can beat you know, free rental codes out of them, or they have promotions. But anyway, so I went to the online. So what you could do is you can go online and reserve one, and then when you show up at the kiosk, it's in there and it holds it for you, and then you swipe your card and it gives it to you.
Right.
Otherwise, not all of kiosks have all the movies. And then I noticed they were showing some titles twice. Well, the reason they were showing titles twice, Dave, is that they're starting to rent Blu-ray. And I'm like, No, I think it's more. I think it's $1.50 or something instead of $1.
Okay.
But also, my local video store has Blu-ray as well. So I decided, you know, let me take another look at what's out there. So I looked at what's out there, and the two places I went to. So we have a local, it's one of these warehouse stores called BJ's. And
sure,
they have a lot of consumer electronics for pretty cheap. And then just to even it out, I went to the local Walmart. And I looked at all the stuff that they had. I brought my iPod Touch, so I was typing in the model. I probably should have taken pictures, so that may have started freaking them out. But basically, I was there. Now, they didn't know if I was, you know, recording the information or texting or whatever, but I was basically just taking down all the model numbers and the prices so I could then go back home, go online, and just find out what the best bang for the buck is. But I was really looking for instant gratification. And I managed to find a Sylvania basic, you know, no Wi-Fi, no network, no nothing, just a Blu-ray player. I think you can play, I think it has, you know, an SD card reader. But anyways, it works fine. Came with the HDMI cable, which, you know, a lot of people, I mean, even in the Walmart, they had them on special hooks where you couldn't just take them because, I mean, they, even they nail you for, I mean, it was ridiculous. So basically, the player came with the HDMI. I have two HDMI on my TV.
Great.
And it looks wonderful. But here's the thing. So the only downside is that not having a network interface. Now, some of these require firmware updates. And so I went to Slovenia, and I'm like, oh, let me check it out. And they have a kind of neat way of doing it. You download the file. It's a zip file, and then it decompresses to a bin file. And then you put it on a piece of media. In this case, it would have to be, you know, it could be a CD, a CDR, a DVD, RW, whatever.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to look at it and say, oh, okay, here's a software update. Great. You want me to update it? It's like, yeah, sure. So downloaded it, put it on a CDRW, I think, to start. Did it on the Mac side. And here's that now the technical question. Because so after I wrote it to that, went over to the player, put the disc in, and it's like, oh, here's a software update for me. You want me to read this and update? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And it sits there for a couple of minutes. And then it says, there's an error. Download and do it again. And I'm like, oh, man.
Try another piece of media.
Well, I tried that too, but then here was my other question, Dave. So of course, the burning, is, I used the built-in burning feature
okay.
of the Mac. Now, the one thing I thought, so what I did is I highlighted the disk I had just burned, and the format type was macOS 10 Extended, or macOS Extended. Like, oh, maybe because the instruction said to do it on a PC. So what did I do? I fired up VMware, and I did the same thing. Pulled over the file, and I burned it within VMware.
Yep.
And that came out as an ISO 9660
yep.
disk, which is, you know, we'll cross platforms. Put that in, same thing.
Huh.
The only thing is that I do believe the default behavior of the Mac is that it will, if you use the built-in burning, because I was looking for a way to specify the format. And I believe the default is that they will make a disk that will be readable on both. Is that if you put it in a... If right. you put it in a Mac, it'll come up as Mac OS Extended. If you put it in a PC, it'll come up as the ISO 9660. I believe that's the default behavior of the built-in burning. And as I found, at least the burning on XP, it makes it as an ISO 9660 only. But I don't know what's wrong. I mean, after this, their service is open. I'm going to call. Now, the one thing you could say is, John, why are you messing with it? It seems to work fine.
Right. But, John, why are you messing with it? It seems to work fine.
Well, people have warned me that due to the relatively new nature of Blu-ray and just due to some of the wacky copy protection stuff, it doesn't hurt to upgrade the firmware. Now, maybe I shouldn't even bother. I mean, I've only had one disc where the beginning was, it was a DVD, not a Blu-ray, and it had a little glitch on the intro, but everything I played on it so far. So, you know, the first night I got it, I did a double header. I did Minority Report and Fifth Element. And those are pretty nice HD movies.
Cool.
So it's fun, but I'm scratching my head over it. So number one, I don't know if you know off the top of your head what the default behavior does, or if you can...
I have a couple of ideas. So sure. One is that you could just have crummy media. Computers are far more,
sure.
you know, far more tolerant than all the media players, you know, dedicated media players, DVD players, CD players that I've seen. So it could just be, and I've seen it where it's not just one bad piece of media, but the whole stock doesn't hit a certain specification and it never works, especially true with the DVD dual layer media. CDs seem to be pretty good, even if you buy the cheap bulk ones. I haven't had a real problem with them, but maybe the Blu-ray player doesn't like it. So that's possibility number one, in which case, mm-hmm. you know, the rest of this is a losing battle. The thing is, I believe Windows does this too. The Mac, when it burns a CD, I don't think it closes the session. I think it leaves it, or it doesn't close the disk. It finalizes the session, but it doesn't close the disk so that it allows you to burn more and more to one disk. So the player may not like, if assuming the Mac and Windows are both doing this, the player may not like it. I would recommend using something, it's a commercial package, of course, but something like Toast, where you can really control not just the format, but you know, whether it's going to close and if it's going to burn it at single speed or 8-speed or whatever, you know, you really can get into the nitty gritty with something like that and drill down and know exactly what you're creating. Cause you could create a UDF or an ISO 9660 right. or whatever with Toast and make that disc exactly what you want without the OS getting in the way and saying, no, trust me. I know what to do. You know, so that's where I would go with it is I would try it with Toast.
Yep. Yeah, I think I got that kicking around somewhere.
Yep.
So.
Yep. Even an older version of it, as long as it, you know, as long as it runs, should work totally fine for what you're doing here. So that, that would be my thought. But yeah, I don't
know. All right. But it's pretty exciting.
I gotta back up a minute. What happened here was, in the course of less than a day, you made a significant purchase decision. This isn't something you hemmed and hawed over for 6 months, and you made an impulse buy with a gadget, and that's pretty cool. I think that, you know, that qualifies for like celebration.
Movie party at my place tonight.
Sweet.
Everybody stop by.
I'm on my way down. All right.
But no, my criteria as a value minded consumer was that I really don't want to pay more than $100 for a Blu-ray player.
All right.
And this was $86 plus tax. It was $90. Now, the thing is,
you did the right thing, because you can go crazy researching Blu-ray players, and in the end, you just want something that's going to play movies, and that's that. Now, maybe you do want, you already have something that can play Netflix.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. All the other features some had 802.11n built in, some had network ports, some had Pandora and Netflix and Amazon. And it's like, the TiVo already has that. So all I needed was basic, and I was able to get that. Now, the thing is, I do have a DVD player that I'm not using anymore, so maybe I'll send it
to Gazelle.com.
I looked. I think they still look. They definitely accept Blu-ray players. I think. I mean, I may not get a lot for it.
Sure.
But cool. I have no use for it now. So.
Right. There you go. Perfect. That's awesome. Yeah, you did the right thing. That's been my problem, and that's why we don't have a Blu-ray player. Because every time I think about it, I start over-researching it, and really, for $80, you just go buy one and don't think about it. But just put it, plug it in, and that's the end of that.
Yeah, how long ago were those things, you know, $1,000?
Right.
$800?
Right.
Oh, I love
it. Oh, it was insane.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the market's adapting. I certainly saw them for more, but it had way too many. It was getting way too confusing. I'm like, let me find the thing that is basic. And
just does what I want.
Right. So again, Dave, I'm going to have the big movie party tonight, so you know you may want to call us and ask us for direction. No.
206-666 geek, which is
4335, or you could certainly email us with your questions, comments, concerns,
feedback@macgeekgab.com.
And I know you said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Oh, you heard me right. I said feedback@macgeekgab.com. Or if you're a premium subscriber, and we really appreciate it if you are, premium@macgeekgab.com. Not only with a premium subscription do you get an extra 2 episodes a month at least, but you also get the warm, comforting feeling of knowing that you've directly supported your 2 favorite geeks. So there you have it. You can Skype to MacGeekGab. And you can leave us iTunes comments, to which we cannot respond. But we can respond to everything else you mentioned. So do it all. It's fun. Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast converts this to AAC for your enhancement. Cashfly provides all the bandwidth at cashfly.com to get the podcast from us to you. Blog World Expo in October, the 14th through the 16th. I've almost booked my flights. Flights got cheaper a little bit today. So October 14th through 16th. I think I'm actually going to fly out on the 14th. I don't think I'm attending the social media thing because I've got a scheduling deal, but I'll definitely be there for the 2 days, the Friday and Saturday of Blog World Expo. If you want to come, use the coupon code OBSERVERVIP, OBSERVERVIP. That gets you 20% off of whatever the going rate is for a ticket to Blog World Expo. So a pass to Blog World Expo. So that you definitely want to make sure you take advantage of that. Podcast Marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo from Barebone Software, Disc Label from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and Gazelle.com with the coupon code MacGeek gets you 5% off. I think that's it, John.
A lot of geek.
Just a lot of geek. Hey, man, you know, that's how we roll around here. Pete, thanks for stopping by. It's good to have you here. It's been too long.
It has been. No, just working too hard.
I know.
You know, they quit sending paychecks, so if I don't go to work, they quit sending them. I don't get it.
That's just not right.
That's just true.
Well, you just need to make sure that if you're not going to work, that you don't get caught. Made up.